Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Mind Yourself podcast in association with MOTUS. My next guest is a PhD student at the University of Texas studying a fascinating topic. With several publications in the area, William Costello studies people who identify as involuntarily celibate or incel. After working in the area of career guidance and education, William began researching incels during a psychology master's at Brunel University and is now working in David Buss's evolutionary psychology lab. William, thank you very much for coming on. Have I got all that correct? Yeah.
All of that sounds good. Great intro.
Fantastic. My first question, William, is for listeners who don't know what an incel is, in your own words, how would you define it?
So incels are a largely online subculture community of men who form a strong sense of their identity around what they perceive as their entire inability to form sexual or romantic relationships. Now, the community, a significant minority within the community, engage in very misogynistic online hostility and frustration and blame towards society for failing to include them. And an even rarer minority still go on to commit acts of violence. And 59 people around the world have been killed in acts of violence by frustrated incels. There's been a couple of high profile cases whereby some have made manifestos about wanting to exact revenge on the world. Yeah. So these get a lot of high profile media attention. But my idea after doing a lot of the research is that incels, yes, present some significant danger to society, but they're far more dangerous towards themselves when we look at their mental health and suicidality.
Okay. And please correct me if I'm wrong here, William, like from my very brief research into your area, this is quite a new field. You're one of the first researchers to kind of be focusing on this. So can I ask, why were you interested in the topic at first? And maybe if you could give a brief overview of like, when did this type of research start into this subculture?
Yeah, so the old joke in academia is that research is me-search. So I don't know what to say about that in terms of info.
I won't comment.
No comment is right. No, but in terms of from a career point of view to any maybe graduate students listening or undergraduate students, I thought that the incel topic was the sweet spot in terms of a career move because it had lots of media attention, lots of online attention, lots of attention from the public. But at the time I started to do my research, there was literally no empirical primary data on incels. There was a handful of studies that was analyzing language in their online forums and things like that, but actually no primary studies. So I'm one of the earliest and one of the first to have some actual data like that, which is a great career move for me because you kind of have a founder effect. Yes. But I was interested in the topic more generally. I'm interested in human mating psychology more broadly because we're a sexually reproducing species. Every single human being alive is the result of an unbroken chain of evolutionary ancestors who solved the problem of finding a mate for long enough to reproduce. We build billion-dollar industries around mating in the form of dating apps, cosmetic surgery, we write songs, poetry, we go to war, all for love and mates. So the idea that there's a modern group of incels who form a strong sense of identity around feeling excluded from this, which I think many of us would agree, romantic relationships are some of the most rich conscious experiences we can have. So to feel completely excluded from that entirely seemed a very, very interesting kind of identity for me to explore. So my background is evolutionary psychology. We actually do have a rich evolutionary history of incels, and that makes it interesting to me too, because throughout history, many more men have failed to find a mate than women have. Because we have a history of polygyny, meaning one high status male in a society will have multiple wives. 83% of human societies have been preferentially polygynous, which means that a lot of men are actually excluded from the mating market in those societies. And those men, those sexless young men or unpartnered young men, are typically extremely dangerous. In our field, we call it the young male syndrome. and cross-culturally, cross-historically, unpartnered young men have been extremely dangerous for society towards themselves. Because what happens is, if you have no stake in society and you have no, you're on track for an evolutionary zero, you start upping your risk-taking and status striving, and you'll do anything to try and get a mate. And the unfortunate fact is that a lot of the behaviors that would have got you a mate throughout our ancestral history would land you in jail now. So yeah, that's why this group is particularly dangerous. And it's actually a puzzle why incels aren't actually more violent. Yes, there is some violence, but not as much as we might expect, which is also quite interesting.
Okay, you've answered about 10 of my questions already, which is fantastic. But I'm immediately thinking then, like, from the individual perspective, though, like, does it help the individual who identifies as an incel? Does it help them to identify as an incel? Like, is it good for their, like, let's say, mental health, or does it not make a difference?
It's a bit of a mixed bag in terms of the actual outcomes on their mental health. And a lot of incels say they perceive some kind of comfort from the identity. But the way I analyze it is that if the goal is to actually get incels, these guys, to re-engage with the mating market and to form romantic relationships, then it's absolutely not a good identity, because the incentive structure is such that it blocks them from even trying. So, for example, when I started to study this, I thought, how could somebody come to identify with such an aspect of their situation? But I realized they're actually gaining quite a lot out of the identity. So they gain a sense of fraternity with their other friends. They gain a black and white worldview. They gain a victimhood identity. They gain a common enemy. They gain incel language online is very kind of humorous. It's kind of gallows humor, lots of trolling memes and things like this. So for a terminally online young man, like we all are, that's quite appealing. So they trade a place in a mating market that they perceive as quite anxiety inducing and not really doing them much, having much success in, for a place in a coalition, a kind of a fraternity of fellow incels. So that's what's unusual about this modern cohort of incels. So we've had evolutionary history of incels, but they've always been really, really trying to seek mates. This modern cohort is evolutionary novel in that they're not bothering. They're really giving up. They describe it as taking the black pill. Now, taking the black pill is a description of incel philosophy, which means that they believe there's no point in even trying. It's like the, have you heard of the red pill from the movie The Matrix?
Yes.
If you take the red pill, you see the world as it really is compared to the blissful ignorance of the blue pill. The black pill for incels is a particularly bleak truth that there is no point in even trying. There's no chance that they could ever have romantic success.
So am I right in saying that this has, so you mentioned evolutionary psychology, it's always existed, but essentially the internet has facilitated this subculture. It would not exist without it. Would I be right in saying that?
Yeah, so this idea of them galvanizing into a kind of a collective, a group identity, as far as we know, is pretty evolutionary novel. There's maybe some evidence that throughout history, incels might have galvanized together to go and seek mates. But to galvanize around the victimhood identity is very, very novel. And the internet is so interesting because, yes, that's where a lot of the incel harm manifests in terms of the online misogyny and the trolling and the stuff like that. But it might actually be buffering against real world violence, that instead of going out and causing real world violence out on the streets in attempt to seek mates, they're actually having their status striving hijacked and channeled into online forums. So they're committing acts of violence, aggression online, and they're watching pornography, which is meeting their sexual end goals to just a sufficient degree to scratch that itch so they don't need to go out and seek it in the real world. So it might actually be stopping what an otherwise very violent group of young men. It might actually be pacifying them. My supervisor and I wrote a paper about this called Why Isn't There More Incel Violence? And we proposed the male sedation hypothesis, this idea that the internet might just be pacifying these otherwise violent young men.
And is the identification getting more common? Have you looked at like population studies, or is it something that you think could possibly die out in a generation or two?
I think so. Some of my co-authors disagree with me slightly on this. The incel subculture is likely, we won't have heard of it in 100 years, but we will have this familiar feeling of some men having resentment, aggression, frustration at being excluded. So maybe we need to think of a broader term than incel, which is very much kind of like this online subculture. My co-author calls it dysphoric singlehood. So this strong feeling of discomfort with being single, that might be a more sustainable kind of phenomenon. But in terms of nuts and bolts numbers of incels, there's about 22,000 users of the main online incel forum right now. But it's kind of, it always ebbs and flows around that number. But it depends on how you define incel, because if you define incel by just the circumstance alone, somebody who is involuntarily celibate, then rates of sexlessness, particularly among young men, are increasing. Young people are actually less risk-taking. They're having less sex, taking less drugs, drinking less, driving less. They're just kind of, and again, it maybe is the internet, that there's just better things to do at 10 p.m. on a Friday night than going out trying to find partners. I don't know if that, I can't relate to that, Christy. Can you?
I'm sure. I hate always bringing up the C word, but I'm sure COVID might have actually influenced that as well, of course.
Maybe.
And so you mentioned that there's kind of mixed findings in relation to people identifying as incels, that there's mixed findings in that it can sometimes not maybe help their psychological well-being, but it might not make it worse. Is there a possibility that psychological well-being could predict incel identification? Like, for example, if somebody does have low mental health, is that a predictor of identifying?
Yeah, so all our findings we suggest are bi-directional. So if you're incel, it will make you depressed. Not being able to find a mate will make you depressed. But equally, depressed men aren't attractive prospects on the mating market. So it's kind of a reciprocal kind of relationship there. I think with the misogyny, there's evidence that unwanted celibacy creates misogyny, but also misogynistic men aren't very attractive to women. So it's kind of this bi-directional relationship all around, a vicious cycle.
And have you looked at any other possible predictors other than obviously being celibate, but have you come across any other predictors that could predict identifying as an incel?
Yeah, a huge one is autism spectrum disorder. So previous research had found that 18% of incels self-reported having an autism spectrum disorder diagnosis. Now, that wasn't measured, that was just self-report. Now, in our most recent study, we used a clinical scale called the AQ-10 scale, which is the autism quotient measure. And basically, it's a 10-item measure, and participants who score 6 out of 10 or above, 80% of those go on to get a clinical diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder. In our sample of incels, which is the biggest sample of incels of any study to date, 30% met the clinical diagnosis criteria. So that's either saying that 30% are likely have a diagnosis or would qualify for a diagnosis and should be seeking the clinical support. But that is extraordinarily high, because the global prevalence of autism spectrum disorder is around about 1%. So for 30% of a particular community, it's extraordinarily high. And there's some, maybe we can think about reasons why men with autism spectrum disorder might struggle to navigate a kind of complex mating market that relies on social cues of flirting, a lot of social skills. But there's also some interesting evidence that the users of incel forums used to be the users of pickup artist forums. So how we might imagine that working is that a young man, particularly a man with autism spectrum disorder, might try the crude tactics you would learn on a pickup artist forum, try that in the real world, realize it doesn't work, and reach the black and white conclusion that, oh, I must be incel. I've tried all of these tactics. The pickup artists tell me they don't work. I must be incel. So we're actually writing a paper on that now about incels on the spectrum, kind of talking about why the incel identity might be attractive to men with ASD. And, you know, it's a very black and white way of thinking.
Yeah,
they lack a theory of mind about the other sex. They make fundamental mistakes about women, what women want. So all of that might be just reflecting the high levels of autism in the community. Mm,
it makes sense. And like, I know obviously it shouldn't be focused, but like in relation to interventions, which I'm going to ask you in a while, like it actually could be a great idea to kind of focus on a specific population as well to prevent that. I'm also thinking, you mentioned about the violence being lower in incels as well, is quite interesting. I wonder what the violence levels are like with people who are diagnosed with autism as well. Could there be kind of an overlap there? Going back to that violence piece then, William, can I ask about, like when you looked at violence, did you look at a specific type of violence, like sexual violence, or was it just violence in general?
We did actually. We looked at sexual violence. So a common measure for ascertaining whether men have a propensity for sexual violence is to ask a question about, if you could get away with it, would you rape a woman if you could, if you knew you would not get found out? And 13% of incels say they would. And that sounds extraordinarily high. And you think, oh my God, wow, that's quite scary. Until you realize that other studies have found that among general populations of men, the figures are about between 20 to 30%. So it's actually, they're quite less prone to committing acts of sexual violence. And this is actually a common misunderstanding about sexual violence more broadly. People think that frustrated young men who don't have any other way to get a mate are the most likely to commit sexual violence. But in actual fact, it's highly narcissistic, sexually successful men who are already sexually successful who are most likely to commit sexual violence. And there's one in the media right now, Russell Brand, maybe the archetype of somebody who could just never possibly believe that a woman wouldn't want him. He's the one that feels entitled. You hear about incels feeling entitled to women. I think the precise opposite is true. They actually are fundamentally focused on the fact that they are inadequate. It's the Russell Brands of the world that feel entitled to as much sex as they can get.
I've also like read around how it's more like rape, for example, is more about power as opposed to actual sex, like wanting sex. It's not about that. It's more motivated by exerting power over somebody else. Mm.
I totally disagree with that one. That's another common misunderstanding. So
go on.
Rape is almost certainly about sex. Rape victims are almost exclusively fertile age women. Sexual violence almost falls off a cliff and stops happening after menopause for women, even though they're just as likely to be attacked or robbed or mugged. If rape was about power and exerting power, no one is more powerless than an elderly woman living on her own. But they're almost never raped. They get no sexual attention, negative or positive. It's certainly about sex, and I can send you a lot of papers on that. You can send to your viewers if you want, but it's a common misconception as well.
And yeah, so that would be primarily whatever you're right in saying. It makes sense what you're saying from an evolutionary psychology perspective. So I know you mentioned already that like the majority of your research is based on that perspective. Is there any alternative ways of understanding incel that you've kind of thought about? I'm weary. I know I've said to you before not to go into too much detail about frameworks and stuff, but on a surface level, are there any other ways of looking at it?
Sure. I mean, that's actually why they're such an interesting group, because evolutionarily, they're a group that are choosing a coalitional identity of their friendships over participating in the mating market. I mentioned at the start of the show how fundamental mating is to human beings. So to have a group who are backing away from that purposefully is extremely evolutionary novel. It's remarkable. So there must be other more proximate incentives. So like, they're literally overriding their evolutionary drives. And that's where maybe pornography and things like that are coming into play, because they're scratching the evolutionary itch. They're giving a what we call a counterfeit fitness cue. So your brain sees the sexual stimulus on the screen, you ejaculate, you think, wow, that's an evolutionary success. Keep doing what you're doing. Stay at home. You don't need to. So it's a remarkable kind of time in human mating. We have control over our reproduction for the first time ever. It's a very evolutionary novel time.
Okay, interesting. And so you formerly worked in education and career guidance. So I'm kind of going to move towards intervention now, like in relation to like your previous experience and your current research experience. Like, do you see an overlap with incel research and education or any possible interventions?
Interventions is the kind of the area we all need to get into. Almost every incel paper that's written now says we need to start moving towards interventions, but it's extraordinarily difficult because incels are very resistant to interventions, to mental health support. So I very strongly believe that there needs to be a really specific therapeutic approach designed, and practitioners maybe need to be trained specifically, and incels might engage with that, but the therapeutic approach as it is right now, they're incredibly resistant to it. They tell me they feel dismissed, that their problems aren't taken seriously. One fundamental aspect of incel personality is they have a strong need for recognition and for self-verification. So they actually prefer information, even if it's extremely negative, that verifies their own self-view. So you can imagine an incel going into therapy and someone with unconditional positive regard trying to say, oh, come on, you're not so bad. You can improve. You can go out and get a girlfriend. That's hell to them. They hate to hear that. They want to hear, yes, you must really struggle. That's really tough. You know, so even practitioners knowing things like that about incel psychology would help them engage with any incels that appear in their clinical room.
But again, just going back to the well-being aspect as well, like is a part of the identity of an incel that they have to identify that they can't be happy with their identity. Does that make sense? So it's kind of a...
Not necessarily, but they are very bleak about all aspects of life. And yeah, they kind of tend towards the negative affect of everything. Even their humor is all very gallows humor style. They're locked in. And like I say, the incentive structure is so wrong that they actually resist and stop each other from breaking out of it. So if an incel talks about a way in which they seek comfort in something, people in the forums will say, oh, that's just cope. You're just coping. You should really just see the black pill truth that you're a loser. So it's very, very self-defeating. And kind of, yeah, negative reinforcement all the way down. And any positive cognitive behavioral therapy kind of techniques that you see incels trying to do on themselves, that's shut down by the other ones in the forum. So the forums are quite kind of negatively reinforcing.
Yeah, it's funny. Like, I'm just thinking, like, with a clinic, well, obviously I'm not educated on it, but with a clinician's hat on, just like, would the approach of therapy be to break down the identity, or would it be to kind of just deal with the mental health symptoms? You know, it's interesting.
So, in some of the interviews I've done with incels, I always ask the questions, because I've done some qualitative interviews with them too, and I would always ask the question, how would you know you're no longer incel? What would have to have changed? Have sex once, have a relationship, and they always describe it like an alcoholic. They say, oh, you could relapse at any time. It wouldn't matter. Even if I got a girlfriend, she'd probably be cheating on me anyway. So it really is a mindset, an identity, a worldview. So yeah, I agree with you, Chrissy. I think that would have to be changed. And I think you'd have to channel them towards different extreme online identities, because we're all terminally online. So it's not really realistic to say, oh, a common kind of thing said to incels is go outside, touch grass, as if this will just fix their problems. I mean, we should all go outside more, yes, but we don't. We're all terminally online. So I think alternative online identities would be more realistic.
Okay. And in that qualitative research, this was the paper when you were looking at perceptions, I think I came across it, of incels in general. So did you have any other interesting findings when looking at that research qualitatively?
Their attitudes to therapy, their negative experiences of therapy. We had one incel we interviewed that he said he had tried 9 different therapists and couldn't form a therapeutic alliance with any of them. So clearly there's some breakdown. You have an at-risk, hard-to-reach group. I think that's where I'm more confident in interventions. I'd rather maybe work with clinicians to train them and develop something that might seem appealing to incels, because they talk to me, you know, because they see me as a good faith kind of actor. So if there was a therapy designed from that starting point, maybe they would embrace it. But therapy as is, I think they're just going to shut it down. They're not open to it.
Okay. And is that a possible end goal now for your PhD, for your project?
Perhaps, yeah. We're already working with the NHS to do like CPD kind of programs, but we haven't worked to specifically design an intervention program per se yet. But we're forming some good relationships with people who might be able to help.
Great.
I don't come from the clinical background, so ideally I would want a team of clinicians who could say, you know, work with me from that side of things, and I'll tell them everything I know about incels. That would be a good deal.
Fantastic. Okay. And then I only have a few more questions now, William, but moving away from incels completely, because you obviously would have read around just from an evolutionary psychology perspective, mating. I saw that you had a paper on cross-sex mind reading. So this is how much one sex thinks about the other sex wanting to have sex with them. Just in your own words, what are some interesting findings or some interesting research that you found out about mating in general that are relevant today from a evolutionary psychology perspective? It's a big question, I know.
One of the big ones I think would be really useful for people to know is about the male overperception bias. This is a very strong finding from evolutionary psychology, and you might kind of recognize it in your own friendship groups, that men tend to overperceive sexual interest from women even when it's not there. And that's because of something called error management theory. Ancestrally or evolutionarily, it was less costly to be mistaken in that direction. It's less costly to perceive interest when there is none than to miss the interest when it is there. So the example I always use is, have you ever seen the movie Dumb and Dumber?
Yes.
So you know when he says, what are the chances that a gal like you would be interested in a guy like me? He says, like, 1 in 1,000. And she says, more like 1 in 1,000,000. And he says, so you're saying there's a chance. So that's kind of the way the male mind works, is we perceive interest from women even when it's not there, just in case. It's like you want a smoke alarm that's really overactive rather than razor sharp accurate. Better to be mistaken in that direction. This is so strong that a supermarket chain had an employability training scheme where they advised their checkout staff to smile and make eye contact with the customer as they're paying. They had to abandon this scheme after 2 weeks because so many men were just lingering on with their phone number on a piece of paper waiting to give it to the women, because they said, she smiled at me, she wants me, obviously I'm going to wait around. So this is really problematic, because women, for many different reasons, sometimes feign romantic interest because it's quite scary to give a direct rejection to a man. He might get angry. He might not take it so well. It's just kind of mean sometimes. Women maybe sometimes want to feel good about feeling desired. So there's a million different reasons women might feign romantic interest, but men are perceiving all of this as massive interest. So there's a failure of cross-sex mind reading there as well. Another example is sexual disgust. So men are obviously very guilty of often sending the unsolicited dick pics. That's precisely because they would love to receive such a picture themselves from a woman. And there's a it was a Vice article of a female journalist who said she wanted to take revenge on men, and she was going to reverse the order of things and send unsolicited pictures of her own genitalia to men. And obviously this backfired extremely because the men were thrilled to receive these pictures. So men are thinking, oh, I would love to receive such a picture. I'll send one to the woman. And it's obviously not the case. It almost never is received positively.
And would you say now these are all biological processes? They're kind of like innate within us, essentially, or?
Well, certainly they're adaptive. So those errors, those failures of cross-sex mind reading on men are actually adaptive. Our ancestors aren't the men who wondered for too long whether she was smiling at him. Our ancestors are the ones who took the chance and kept going, which is, you know, I'm not suggesting men should like be extremely persistent and stuff like that, but certainly that is the case.
Okay. And obviously, now you mentioned the dating apps at the start in relation to incels, but just in general, from like an evolutionary psychology perspective, like, do you have any insight into certain behaviors on dating sites like Tinder or Bumble?
Yeah,
or
dating apps are obviously an extremely evolutionary novel kind of mating market. If you think about ancestrally, your mating market would have consisted of maybe a couple of dozen potential mates in a lifetime. And that's why maybe rejection is processed as so catastrophic. Because if you really think about it now in the modern world, getting rejected by even 10 women a day shouldn't be that catastrophic because there's millions. You literally go online and there's millions. But it is processed that way because our psychological mechanisms evolved in response to environments where there was only a few mates and your reputation of being rejected was very costly. That's why there's dating anxiety, because it's costly to be rejected. So another way that dating apps mess with our mating psychology is just this impression of an infinite amount of partners. That makes one very reluctant to commit to long-term mating, because if you've been given the impression there's so many other options out there, it's very hard to commit to just one person.
Mm.
It also, yeah, so there's lots going on. Also the sex ratio, the dating apps consist of far more men than women. So there's lots of problems there, but it makes the attraction inequality extreme. Some men get a lot of attention on dating apps, but most men get none. It's because it removes attraction down to static kind of markers of attractiveness. So the example I always use is there's no opportunity on a dating app for a charming Irish accent to overcompensate for being 5'7". That's a personal anecdote I just plucked out of nowhere.
enjoyed. And then, yeah, so William, like, obviously now you're becoming one of the leading experts in incel research. You have insight into again, like mating preferences from an evolutionary perspective. So like down the line, where are you seeing your research career go? What would you be interested in researching, or would you prefer to stay focused on incel research?
For now, I'll be focusing on incels. I thought I would drop the topic quite soon after starting my PhD. I thought, oh, it's a bit niche, but it's actually gathering so much kind of attention from government bodies. Publications are interested in working on it. Maybe there might be a book down the line, things like that. So I'll stick with it for a while, because I see it as a symptom of a broader kind of mating crisis generally, rather than just a specific weird niche subculture. It's about everything that goes into it that's interesting to me. But yeah, I will eventually move on to more broad mating psychology stuff. That's the only game in town as far as I'm concerned. But for now, incels is my focus.
Perfect. Sorry, I feel like I'm interviewing you now with some of the questions. But last question then, I've asked this to all the PhD students. So you obviously, William, took the big jump. You moved to the US to focus on your research. So do you have any advice for maybe psychology graduates who are interested in going into PhD or just current PhD students? Do you have any recommendations or advice?
Yeah, maybe a bit of an unusual piece of advice, and a lot of scholars might agree with me, but honestly, building a large online presence has helped my career immensely. Just writing pop science articles and getting them out there, tweeting a lot, building a following, because an online presence in academia, it allows the literature to flow to you. You're following all the right people anyway, and anytime they release something, they'll post it. So it just allows an organic flow of the current literature directly to you. And the other way around, it allows you to amplify anything you've got. So the amount of downloads I might get on an article of mine compared to other scholars in my cohort is just a different ballgame. Academia, for way too long, in my opinion, is way too gated and ivory.
Segregated.
I make all my articles free on ResearchGate. It maybe costs $40 to buy them if you wanted to do it legit, but you can just look on my ResearchGate and I'll post them for free.
Fantastic. I think that's actually great advice that isn't told enough. There's such a gap, as you said, between academia and the general public. So that's great. So William, that's essentially it. Do you have anything you want to add about any of your research at the moment, or any future research coming up that I didn't mention?
I can't think of anything at the moment, but kind of related to my last point, if anybody wants to keep up to date with what we're doing, if you follow me on Twitter, or X as it's called now, at Costello William, you'll be able to keep up with all my work. I post it there in my highlights, and terminally online man. So there's plenty of William Costello online, and fill your boots.
Perfect. I will add that to all of the show notes. And thank you so much for doing this, William. Really, really grateful. So thank you.
No, thanks for having me, Christy. Good luck. Perfect.